Omaha Public Radio presents a special program from Bellevue University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a panel discussion on the topic, The Financial and Mortgage Industry Crisis, What It Means for Business and You. This program is part of the Bellevue University College of Business Speaker Series. The members of the panel are Eric Bunderson, Vice President of American National Bank, Mike Gallagher, Vice President of Human Resources at Harrah's Horseshoe in Council Bluffs, and Pat Miner, Vice President and Public Bond Portfolio Manager at Mutual of Omaha. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, October 9th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Bellevue University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Kevin Shire, Professor of Finance in the Bellevue University College of Business.
We're excited and pleased to have three business leaders with significant knowledge and experience join us to share their perspectives of the status of the current financial markets. Our business leaders will provide us with insights to the credit and capital markets from a macroeconomic perspective, as well as some of the microeconomic concerns within their industries and specific companies. I'd like to go ahead and introduce our guest today. In the middle, Patrick Miner is with Mutual of Omaha in Portfolio Strategies and Management Division. Pat joined Mutual of Omaha in 1992 after nearly 6 years with two national brokerage firms and over 7 years in the portfolio manager for Norwest Corporation. Pat is a chartered financial analyst and a member of the CFA Institute as well as the CFA Nebraska chapter. Pat's responsibilities includes management of Mutual of Omaha and United of Omaha's public corporate bonds, residential mortgage-backed and commercial mortgage-backed and asset-backed securities portfolios totaling over $6 billion, and the Mutual of Omaha Bank investment portfolio. Pat also coordinates all economic studies and reports in the investment staff. He has been a speaker at insurance and asset and liability management forums and structured securities industry seminars. Pat earned his business administration degree from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Pat will talk to us about some of the top-down perspective issues and the macroeconomic issues in the capital markets. On your left is Mike Gallagher. Mike is Vice President of Human Resources for Harrah's and Horseshoe Casinos in Council Bluffs, which is part of the Harrah's Entertainment Group, the world's largest gaming corporation with nearly 50 casinos worldwide. Mike joined Harrah's about 18 months ago and is responsible for all HR functions for the two properties and approximately 1,800 employees. Prior to joining Harrah's, Mike was Regional Vice President of Human Resources for SuperValu Incorporated, the nation's third largest grocery distributor. Mike worked in several HR capacities at SuperValu for over 25 years. Mike is a native of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and is both a UNI Panther as well as an Iowa Hawkeye, having received his undergraduate degrees from the University of Northern Iowa Panthers and his JD Law degree from the University of Iowa Law School. Mike graduated with high distinction, was managing editor of the Iowa Law Review, and practiced law with Iowa's largest firm prior to entering the business world. Mike and his wife reside in Council Bluffs, and he'll talk about issues regarding the gaming industry and his firm. On your right is Mr. Eric Bunderson. Eric is Vice President at American National Bank and People's National Bank in Omaha. Eric is responsible for loan reviews and serves as the loan review and compliance manager. Prior to joining American National Bank, Eric worked 14 years for Great Western Bank. His duties there included credit analyst and lender in the commercial real estate department, as well as vice president in the loan review management and credit administration management divisions. Prior to working in banking, Eric worked at HDR Incorporated for 14 years as an architect. Eric earned his MBA from Creighton University and Bachelor of Science in Management from Bellevue University. He serves on Bellevue University's College of Business Advisory Board, is a member of Leadership Omaha's Class 22, and was Coalition Chair for the Habitat for Humanity. Eric will address different current market effects on banking and the credit industry and the microeconomic implications of the current situation. On behalf of Bellevue University and the College of Business, I'd like to express our appreciation to Pat, Mike, and Eric for joining us today. I'd also like to recognize their firms and thank them for their role in they play in enhancing our College of Business, as all three firms are represented on the College of Business Advisory Board. We'll go ahead and get started, and each individual will talk for a few moments, and then at the end of the session, we'll have time for question and answers, so please make some notes as we go through for questions. Patrick, if you'd like to go ahead and talk.
I'll start with the disclaimer that most of the opinions I'm going to express today are my own, not necessarily those of the company. Some people in the company listen to them, but maybe not everybody, so I at least have to get the disclaimer out. A lot of people call the situation we're in a subprime mortgage crisis or a mortgage finance crisis, and I tend to refer to it as something much more broad than that. It's really a financial crisis of a different sort. Subprime mortgages was certainly the trigger that started the demise that we're in, the problems that we have right now. It caused the recognition of the undercapitalization of financial industry. It caused the recognition of excess risks that were taken by the investors and the financial service industry over the last decade. So it's really more of a financial, and now it's become global, a global financial crisis that was triggered by subprime mortgages. Subprime mortgages maybe is the poster child because it's the most evident and probably the best application of finger pointing that we can come up with at this point in time. But it really was nothing but a trigger to an overall bigger problem. It's led to a lot of capital shortages, massive global delevering. I'll get into a little bit more about that later. That's going to continue for some period of time. Restriction of credit availability from the top down, from the largest financial institutions in the world to the small individual trying to get a loan at the bank, which is much harder now than it used to be, much harder now than it was 6 months ago, 12 months ago, really over the last decade. There's been a tremendous repricing of all risk assets. You've all read about that in the newspapers, starting with stocks, with the big decline we've had in the stock market. There's also been a repricing of credit risk in terms of fixed income investments and corporate bonds, structured securities, mortgage-backed securities, bank loans, which maybe you saw the headlines this morning. A large bank in Iceland failed and was taken over by the government. Their biggest problem was bank loans, large bank loans for leveraged buyouts across the globe, and it finally caught up with them. And even commodities. However, that's one exception where we actually had an increase in prices. As the repricing occurred over the last several years, commodity prices kept going up and put additional pressure on the financial assets. And, of course, finally, real estate, where there certainly has been a significant repricing, not only in the United States, but also in Australia, in Europe, especially in England. There's been a significant decline in real estate prices abroad as well as in the United States. And as I mentioned earlier, this is a building process. This has gone on for a long time. Home prices in the U.S. effectively topped out in late 2006. So it's been 2 years. Home prices have been coming down for 2 years. We have had really four distinct waves in this crisis. The first one started in August, September of last year. That's really when the subprime issue came to the forefront. It was exacerbated by some accounting rule changes by the Federal Accounting Standards Board that started to force institutions to price their assets at what they called fair market value rather than at book value, or the value they put the assets on the balance sheet. That then exacerbated the problem and made people realize that they had overvalued the assets on the balance sheet and start to realize that their capital position was, in fact, eroding. The next significant event happened in September of last year, where we had some bank failures, one in England and some other failures here in the United States. The third wave culminated with the Bear Stearns collapse in March of this year, and the fourth wave was September of 2008. There's been, and this is certainly the most severe of the four waves. You might liken it to living in Houston in storm season. You've had several big storms over the last 2 years, and now the big hurricane has finally come in and hit the economy, and the resultant destruction of value that goes along with a large storm hitting a community like that. And that's essentially what's happened to the global economy. There's been a large destruction of value. Saw a number this morning that the decline in world stock markets over the past month is larger than the GDP of China. That's a big number. I forget how many trillion it was, but it's a very big number. I thought for a minute, and this is especially where the personal opinion comes in, that I'd talk about the causes of this financial crisis. And it really gets back to the same old thing. History does repeat itself to some extent. We've had investment bubbles in the past in all kinds of asset classes, from tulip bulbs to gold to technology stocks. This time it was multiple asset classes. The most visible is the mortgage market, but there were other asset classes where there was actually a bubble in the price. This was reinforced by really a decade-long infusion of liquidity into the global financial markets. Not only the Federal Reserve in the United States, but banks around the world have been pumping massive amounts of short-term money into the market for a decade. There's been this excess liquidity has caused, on a relative basis, low interest rates. These low interest rates, in turn, caused investors, portfolio managers, to try to increase their yield by the use of leverage. It's happened before, it will happen again, but maybe we'll be a little more cautious for at least the next decade or so. But if you look back in history, bubbles occur one size or another every 10 or 20 years. Certainly every generation, there's some kind of an asset bubble that causes some problem and leads to, shall we say, multi-decade repercussions as we go forward. I'll get to that in a little bit also. And we can't forget the profit motive. That really was driven by the liquidity, by the low real return, low nominal returns that people were getting on investments, and the ever-present need to grow earnings, to always have a constant upward stream of earnings, caused people to lever their investments, to lever their, whether these investments be plant and equipment, commercial real estate, residential real estate. Individuals did the same thing, feeling rather comfortable with the increase in the price of their home, feeling that their balance sheet was improving as their home price was going up, feeling that they were able to take on more debt simply because they had the asset value. And at some point in time, both the lender and the borrower lost sight of the fact that you still need that income flow to pay the service on the debt. Corporations were guilty of the same thing. This particular cycle got maybe more carried away than many in the past because of some developments in the investment markets. First would be the securitization of assets. And this I could talk about for about a half an hour without any problem. But the real crux of the issue is this. The system for generating loans, and we'll use mortgage loans as the prime example. That's why I call subprime the poster boy. The system generated profits for loan originators based on the amount of volume produced and their recurring fees for servicing these mortgages. Originators get paid a fee to collect the monthly payment and send it on, pay the taxes, do whatever. But the principal of the mortgage was packaged up into securities and sold to investors around the globe. The big problem with the German banks we have right now, and Germany really hasn't faced up to the crisis. They haven't come up with any particular solutions for their banks yet. The Germans were very big buyers of securitized U.S. subprime mortgages. The process of securitization causes a disconnect. We call it the agency problem. The originator of the loan has no real responsibility for the performance of the loan. His only motivation is to generate fees by writing the loan and by servicing the loan, and all of the risk is sold to the investor in the securitization market. So that the actual risk taker and the person that's underwriting the loan have totally separate incentives. That disconnect caused some real problems in terms of abuse in the mortgage market. To some extent, you could say the same thing with corporate debt. As collateralized debt obligations became, and that's just a packaging of corporate bonds, some high quality, some low quality, but packaging them up into these securitizations and selling off pieces of it to investors around the globe really continued that agency problem and had a disconnect between the investor in the asset and the person that was originating and underwriting the loan. And sometimes those underwriters had some economic incentive to bend the rules a little bit, to lend a little more, to assume that the house value was going up, so we won't worry about whether there's enough income to cover the mortgage payments. We'll assume that the borrower is going to have an increase in their income over the next several years, and they'll be able to afford it later. Why don't we just come up with maybe a mortgage that has a low payment at the start, and the payment increases over time as their income goes up? That was a good idea. That's called the adjustable rate mortgage, which they'd put a teaser rate on. You couldn't qualify for a mortgage at a 6% yield. You didn't make enough money. So let's make it a 4% yield for a couple of years. You can qualify for that, and in 2 or 3 years, your income will go up, and you can afford the payments at that point in time. The problem is, in many cases, in that interim period, the value of the real estate actually declined below the amount of the mortgage. The mortgage holder was upside down, the payment's going up. He has to decide, do I want to try and make this payment for a loan that's bigger than the value of the property, or should I just give it back to him? And that's what's happening in a lot of places around the United States and even in other parts of the world. And the final excess that occurred in this cycle was the use of derivatives. Derivatives are, theoretically at least, a very good thing. They allow people to hedge risks of all different kinds. But the other side of a hedger is a speculator. And taking some of these risks, some of these macroeconomic systemic risks, and putting them into derivative form allows investors to lever their bet on what they think is going to happen. And they lever it very, very strongly. And a lot of these levered bets were being made by financial institutions. Witness the large broker-dealers in the United States and some of the large banks. We'll back off on the banks. The large broker-dealers, which are pretty much non-existent now. The last two, Morgan Stanley and Solomon Brothers, or Morgan Stanley and who am I missing? Goldman, that's it. Morgan Stanley and Goldman have become bank holding companies. While they were broker-dealers, they levered their balance sheet on average 25 to 30 times. Lehman Brothers was trying desperately to go from 30 down to 25 when they just ran out of time and had to file for bankruptcy. They would take this levered money that they had and invest that money in some of these derivative instruments and some of these securitizations that were, in a sense, leveraged bets on a particular outcome in the economy. That results in huge leverage that if you're wrong, or if you have to all of a sudden mark, if you're wrong in terms of timing, but you're right in the actual bet that you're making, you can still run out of time when you have something similar to a margin call, and that's what happened with the FASB pronouncements. They had to mark their assets down, and they tried to make the case that that's okay, we can wait it out, we have enough capital. But with a change in accounting standards, they weren't able to hold the market price, and the capital started to erode. So what we have is a global system, a global financial system, that essentially is undercapitalized. It's led to the failure at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's led to Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers going away. All of the banks in Iceland now have been nationalized. Four banks in England have been taken over by the government, one in Holland, actually two in Holland. Germany hasn't faced the music yet. We've had Merrill Lynch being sold. It's truly a global financial crisis. It's probably reached its peak in terms of panic at this point in time. But nonetheless, in the month of September, late September, about the 17th, the world financial system was close to total failure. There was basically no credit available for financial institutions anywhere in the world. It truly was a crisis of massive proportions, one we've really never seen before. And there are going to be a lot of consequences for that over the next decade or two as we work out of this global financial crisis, as financial institutions try to build up their balance sheet and retain a normal level of capitalization. And that takes us to maybe to postulate, forecast, use whatever word you want, about what we might see in the future. And there will be some long-lasting repercussions. First and foremost, of course, we'll have greater regulation of financial institutions. That's already happening. The U.S. Treasury has become a de facto regulator of institutions that are financial but non-bank. That's not happened before. We don't have many broker-dealers left in the United States, only small boutiques. So there will certainly be an increase in regulation, and like most anything else that the government does, they'll probably go a little too far and have some unintended consequences that we won't find out about for the next 5 or 10 years. But there will be a massive increase in regulation, not only in financial services, but I think that same mantra will extend into other industries over the next decade or so, especially with the expected outcome in the elections with a strong Democratic Congress. Off-balance sheet leverage, which was prominent over the last decade, is essentially done. That will never happen again. There were a lot of off-balance sheet vehicles in these large financial institutions that allowed them to lever even more than their regulators wanted them to. It's become a realization that you can't really get off balance sheet, because when the music stops, it has to be put back on the balance sheet, and that's caused some severe repercussions for the large banks in the United States. Been a permanent shift in the Fed borrowing program and the expectations of what the Fed is going to do in terms of rescuing failed financial institutions. There's a moral hazard there, and they're going forward. We will see still, maybe not in the large financial institutions, but we'll still see a lot of financial institution failures, and the government's going to have to pick and choose which ones they decide to let fail and which ones they try to rescue. Subprime mortgage market is now become a fringe market. It virtually doesn't exist. The Alt-A and subprime mortgage markets are now in the purview of the FHA because no one outside of the government will make those loans. It's going to be much harder to get mortgage loans going forward than it has been for the last 20 years. I remember when I first went to get a mortgage for my first house, I was sweating bullets that I wasn't going to get approved. How long has it been outside the last 3 months when somebody went to a mortgage lender and was actually worried that with good credit and a decent job, they were not going to get a mortgage? They just assumed they would. Going forward, that's not going to be the case. It's going to be difficult. It's going to require massive down payments relative to what people have seen in the past, unless you go to a government-subsidized program. There will be a narrowing of the use of securitizations, a narrowing of and substantial regulation of derivative instruments to try to reduce risk. Now, with all the reduction in the ability to take risk, with the reduction in the ability to lever financial balance sheets, what we're going to have is a long period of slower economic growth than we've seen over the last several years. We're going to have a continued restriction of credit at the corporate and the individual level, and we're going to have, for all intents and purposes, fairly subdued returns in the investment markets and the stock markets, simply because we are going to have a lower growth profile going forward, and this may last for a decade or so. It's the bubble took about 10 years to form. It's taken about a year and a half to totally burst and come unglued, and it will take at least 10 years to rebuild some of the damage that we've done up to this date.
Thank you, Patrick. We'll move it over to Mike now and let him talk for a little bit.
Thank you very much, Kevin, and good afternoon to everyone. I'm very pleased to be here this afternoon. I probably should have warned David and Kevin up front that they gave us 10 to 12 minutes or so to talk, and my colleagues will attest I typically can't say hello in that amount of time, but we'll make every effort to do that this afternoon. I'd like to give you a perspective on what's happening in business using what I have observed in the gaming business as kind of a prism, if you will, to help you understand what I've perceived to be the way businesses can and often do react in these kinds of situations. One of the few advantages of having gray hair is that you've seen a bit of history and can give you a perspective on some things. In particular in the gaming business, it's fair to say that to some degree it was a bit of a microcosm of the worldview or outlook that has just been described about the economy in general. This is an industry which for arguably 50 years has had nothing but success and nothing but growth going all the way back into the 1950s. The growth curve was not really even a curve. It was like a 45-degree angle straight up in virtually every company in the industry, regardless of where they were located. I would have to call it probably something akin to unbridled optimism. If you asked people, intellectually, everybody understood that there was a ceiling there. There had to be. The public's appetite for gaming could not continue to increase exponentially, but as to where that ceiling exactly was, really nobody really knew. And that worldview is really what drove the way we all did our businesses, which is to say, if you were looking at a deal and the pro forma looked promising, you did it. There was not a lot of hesitation if the numbers seemed to add up. And I don't mean to say that anyone was wasteful or reckless or careless with their shareholders' money or their own money. But quite honestly, and I had our assistant corporate controller tell me this earlier this year, our attitude tended to be, if we spend capital on this project, that's okay, even if it doesn't really work out because there's more capital where that came from. And that's kind of the way we even interacted with our own employees in general, which is, again, to say we were not wasteful or abusive or reckless, but if these employees tended to leave or chose to go work somewhere else, and I will admit that turnover is endemic to the gaming and hospitality industries, there were more employees where that came from. And that really was the way we pretty much ran our business for a long, long time. And again, a bit like the housing industry, where these kinds of expenditures and these kinds of strategies have to assume that certain things are going to continue. They have to assume there's going to be continued astounding growth. They have to assume that markets are going to continue to grow. They have to assume that the public's appetite for whatever your product is, whether it's bonds or whether it's houses or whether it's blackjack, are going to continue to grow at a seemingly endless rate. And that's kind of where we were. We talked a little bit, you said roughly 2 years ago. Our business was a little bit shorter horizon than that, probably about 18 months ago. Looking back into the middle of 2007, things really began to come to a halt to a large degree in our industry. Gas prices were going up rapidly, more rapidly than anyone could have possibly anticipated. And in most markets, other than Las Vegas, people drive to our casino. In Vegas, they fly in, so you've got a lot of the same kinds of impacts. But in most places, whether it's Council Bluffs or whether it's Hammond, Indiana, people drive to the casinos. And if gas is now double what it was a year ago, less people are going to be driving fewer miles to get to where they want to get to, particularly if it is for fun and not for business. And similarly, if your housing costs are going up or you're suddenly, because of the way your own personal finances are going, you're not making your house payments or it's more of a struggle for your personal finances, you're going to have less money to spend on what presumably is entertainment, unless you're in that tiny fraction of gamblers that do this for a living. And so what we saw almost overnight was an entire industry that flattened out and in some markets actually declined. It didn't here, hasn't here in Omaha Council Bluffs, and I'll touch on that a little bit later. But in a very broad sense, what we saw in the gaming business was the same thing that many industries saw, with revenues being down or flat, with earnings being down. But unfortunately, expenses never seem to fall quite as quickly as the revenues do. And so as a result of that, margins were down. And this was really a universal challenge across our industry, whether you're talking about MGM or Sands or you're talking about Harrah's, which are very, very large multi-billion dollar companies. All of a sudden, it seemed to hit the fan simultaneously every place where we all do business. Now, let me digress just for a moment and make an observation. I have had the opportunity, if that's the right word, to experience similar kinds of challenges in different industries over a period of time. And my observation is that in these situations, companies tend to react in one of three ways. And they actually tend to be somewhat pure reactions, and they don't tend to blur. And the first reaction that companies can have in these very difficult times is, quite frankly, to do nothing. Now, that may seem kind of astounding. How can you do nothing? And it really has to do with, again, your worldview and your past experiences, your life experiences. If you have not seen this kind of a situation before, it may make a lot of sense just to simply hunker down, to pull in your horns, so to speak, in whatever cliche you want to use, and ride it out. Hey, we've not seen this before, but there have been other downturns. If we simply take care of our business, if we simply don't get foolish and continue to do things well the way we've always done them, we'll get through this. Another way to react is to take almost kind of the opposite end of the spectrum and to begin to take a very, very tactical, short-term approach to your business, and that is to drastically and as rapidly as you can reduce those expenses to get down to where your revenue levels actually are. And that kind of a situation you can do for a period of time. And those of you who are business students, if you have not yet heard this in your classes, I hope that you do at some point in time, a very true adage in the business world is that you cannot save your way to prosperity. And that is absolutely true in every business I've ever worked in. At some point in time, revenues have to get back up. They have to continue to grow, because you can't live in a moribund world. You cannot simply continue to cut and presume that at some point magically your profit margins are going to return to where they were, and that you can sustain them for a period of time. And that's the challenge, is that sustainability. But those two reactions were very common, and have been very common, to either do nothing and let's see if we can ride this out, or to cut, cut, cut. And a third way to react, which I'd like to say more enlightened companies, but sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, but some of them have simply said, we can't do nothing. We know we can't save our way to prosperity. So what we need to do is two things kind of simultaneously. You do need to get your margins in line, because you have obligations to your shareholders or to your owners, whether you're a public or privately held company. And in order to give them the returns that they expect and you're obligated to give them, we need to do those things in the near term. But in the longer term, we need to, in effect, reinvent ourselves. We need to look at the way we do business, and we need to understand that if this doesn't change for a lengthy period of time, or quite frankly, if it never changes, and let's assume worst cases, then how are we going to run our business in a way which is going to give our owners, our shareholders, or our private owners the returns that they expect and demand? And I will tell you that I certainly can't speak for Sands or MGM or any of the other companies, but I can certainly speak to what Harrah's has been doing for the last several months, and that is that third approach. But it didn't just happen like, okay, one day we decided we're going to simply reinvent ourselves. We first did not take the first approach. Doing nothing was never in the corporate mind here at Harrah's an option, but trying to reduce the expenses to a place where we were matching our anticipated revenues was naturally our first response. But as the year wore on, as the months wore on, it became very evident to the leaders of our company that that was not going to be a satisfactory solution. And so we did set about to take a very strategic look at our business, a very in-depth but relatively quick analysis of how we do business, to identify best demonstrated practices in every area of our business. Everything from the way our various departments and our properties are structured, the span of control of the people operating in those businesses, our staffing levels, our hours of work, the uniforms that our employees wear, the recipes in our outlets, our food outlets, the policies, and so on. An extremely thorough look in a very compressed period of time to get us on a track that was more likely to lead to success than either folding our hands or frantically simply cutting costs. I was privileged to be at a management meeting in Las Vegas, where our corporate headquarters is located, in June of this year, with the other top executives of our company. And we listened to a presentation by our chief executive officer, a chairman of the board. It was a former Harvard Business School professor and a very bright man, who laid out the charge to our leaders in a very simple fashion. And what he said is, innovation is the engine that will drive our success. And then he went on to say, as a human resources professional, something which made my heart soar, that employee engagement is the fuel that will get us there. Innovation is the engine that will drive our success, and employee engagement is the fuel that will get us there. Simultaneously recognizing that we've got to do things differently. If we don't do things differently, then we are not going to see different results. And quite frankly, that is not an acceptable outcome. But you got to remember who got you the success that you've been enjoying for 50 years, and that's the employees. And I'm not going to sit here and do an advertisement for Harrah's Entertainment and the way we treat our people, but again, that's played a very key role in the way these process changes have played out. The objective, to state it very simply, is in the near term to get all of our key metrics in line to where they need to be, so that for a period of time at least, we can continue to enjoy some measure of success, unless and until, or I should say until that point in time when the economy picks up. And then in a more longer term way, to, as I said before, to reinvent the way we do business. Our fiscal year is a calendar year, and so the near-term objective is to get 2008 in as good a shape as we can get it in, and that's quite frankly easier said than done in many instances and frankly in many markets. But over the longer term, to be able to hit the ground running in our new fiscal year with, in some cases, some radical changes in our processes, in our structures, in the way we deal with our customers, the way we deal with our own employees, so that success in the longer term is a much surer thing than it would be if we did nothing. I'd just like to comment about the Omaha Council Bluffs area. It's a little bit, not a little bit, it's very much an anomaly as we talk about this crisis and as we talk about what's happening in my own industry. While things are certainly not at the levels of those halcyon days of a couple of years ago, it's a little bit of an island in the midst of all of the crisis. The economy in Omaha, in Council Bluffs, where the vast majority of the people who come to play at our casinos reside, is not in bad shape. And from an employment perspective, as a human resources professional, it's in very good shape. It's a very strong labor market with educated, hardworking people who want to come to work, who want to do the right thing, and that's a good place to be. But what it means is the best people who want jobs probably already have jobs. When the unemployment rate is in that 3% range, it's a bit of a challenge to attract a good workforce, so it's a little bit of an anomaly. People do have money to spend here. The gas prices, as we've all seen over these last couple of weeks, yeah, in some extent it's a reflection of the very poor overall economy, but they're below $3, where I got to admit I don't think any of us ever thought we'd see those numbers again. And so this market is not down from a gaming perspective. It's not booming, but it's not down. And so there is money to be made out there for operators who run their business in the right way and, quite frankly, who take care of their employees. So we've had to have a dual focus on process improvement, business improvement, business modifications to some extent, but simultaneously sending a very clear message to our employees that this is still a very good place to work. There is a very good future here for those of you who want a career here. And it's been critical for us to get the employees in the boat with us, so to speak, as we do anticipate significant changes in our business down the road, so that they're with us, and not just simply to share the success that we know is going to come, but to help us make those changes, because in my experience, that's absolutely critical to success in this kind of an environment. So that's the Harrah's perspective and my own business perspective in a nutshell.
Thank you, Mike. Next, we'll hear from Eric and from American National Bank and People's National Bank, and he'll give us a perspective on credit markets.
It was great to hear that perspective and great to hear about a company that's being proactive, and it's really, really nice to see. As far as, I'm just going to talk about banking in general, nothing specific to the institution where I work, but just my experience in banking in this area. And as far as what we've seen in this market, banking really started to take the turn probably early 2007, late 2006. As far as credit, credit's no longer working. The models weren't working anymore. A lot of that, a lot of banking and a lot of economic growth is pushed by jobs. The job growth was stopping. The housing market was starting to slow down, and some of the land development loans were no longer working. So that was starting to come late 2006, early 2007. Also, increased regulatory scrutiny was starting with that. So you could kind of see the slowdown starting quite a while ago. And so the banks have been preparing for this, and the regulators are prepared for this. So it's not something completely new, as Pat was saying. The measure of risk, banks basically measure risk. They buy deposits, and basically, they're borrowing money from the depositors to lend to others, and then they try to keep a piece of the risk. And risk had been pretty much priced out of a lot of lending for quite a while, and that risk premium is starting to come back. That's when deals start going bad, you really see the actual risk premium that you probably should have been charging for quite a while. The London interbank offering rate, that's probably something you've been hearing about lately. It's been kind of the bank rate or the interest rate that's been used internationally. And I think the reason it's really important to us is 50% of the adjustable rate mortgages in the U.S. are priced off of LIBOR. So when you started getting these ARMs and you started getting these products, adjustable rate products to get people into houses, then they see their rates start going up. It's going to be tied to this LIBOR rate. And what's happened is recently, especially with the current meltdown that just happened in September that Pat was talking about, is this LIBOR rate is really spiking up. And if you look at it, that's happened just in a few weeks. It's not something that's happened over a long period of time. There's a lot of variability there, but it's really happening over a really short period of time. So that's going to increase the pressure on homeowners as far as their interest rates and what they're going to have to pay for their houses and what they're going to have to pay to stay in their houses. Bank leverage. The U.S. banks typically are less levered than the European banks. U.S. banks have an average, they loan 96 cents in loans to every dollar in deposits, whereas a European bank has about $1.40 in euro to every dollar in deposits. So you see, like almost all the banks in Iceland, they've failed. A lot of it's interbank lending. There's a lot of European banks that are under extreme stress. There are some U.S. banks, too, that have been under stress and will be. They've had a lot larger loan losses recently, so they've lost a lot of their capital. So that's what's causing a lot of the failure is the high leverage. And when they have this high leverage, they're reliant on that LIBOR to borrow from other banks to fund that leverage. So what that means to us is we have the credit standards are tightening for both consumers and for businesses. And this has been happening over a period of time. It's been happening probably the last 2 or 3 months. Also, credit's going to be harder to obtain, especially if you want to get a home loan. With asset values decreasing, houses are decreasing in value, it's harder to get a home loan. Also, cars and credit cards are where I see probably the next problems occurring. Because people, if you're underwater in a house, you can walk away from your house. You have to stay in your car to get to your job. So people are going to hold on to their jobs. Let's see, what else? And larger banks, probably 5 or 6 months ago, started cutting off the home equity lines of credit. So you can see a lot of tightening in credit now. Reducing leverage. I think Pat talked about delevering in the system and how that's happening. It actually started happening just this last quarter. Consumer installment and revolving debt reduced for the first time in 10 years. So people will stop lending money or borrowing money. Banks will stop lending money, but what that does is it reduces economic activity. And so that's ultimately, I think what's driving the stock markets now is there's a lower expectation of economic growth. And, you know, we just don't know where that's going to go right now. And as far as a bank and as far as, you know, getting money now from a bank, a bank more or less looks as cash as king. So if you have a lot of cash in your statement, if you have a good down payment, that's really going to make it easier to get money. So that's briefly what I have.
Thank you, Eric. It's a few minutes before 1 o'clock. We've got time for a few questions. We would like you, if you have a question, to wait for the microphone. There will be some microphones in the audience.
Mr. Miner mentioned that it's probably going to take a decade or longer to work through all the problems of the crisis. Is there any consensus on when the crisis will bottom? Are we looking another year or two or longer than that?
Consensus, no. Several opinions, and it won't be. We have a lot of crises out there. We have residential real estate. We have bank undercapitalization. Right now, we have a very severe liquidity crisis, and that's what the governments around the globe are addressing. that portion of it, the liquidity crisis, is just about bottomed. I think we're close to the corner there. But the other rolling crises that are a result of the excesses of the last decade are going to happen bottom at different times. Real estate, my personal opinion is maybe late next year. We still have an oversupply relative to the demand, and as that supply-demand imbalance gets back into place, then we'll bottom out. But that'll be somewhat regional, even local, in terms of the bottoming. Bank capitalization and healthy balance sheets in the financial sector, that also will roll, but it's going to be a while. It's going to take a long time to rebuild the lost capital, unless the stock market comes shooting back and they're able to raise more with equity issuance. And as far as the stock market, who knows? Who knows?
It was interesting that you said that the last few years in banking, the risk premium had not been factored into loans. How long has that been occurring, and what, in your view, started that or, you know, caused that to start happening?
I think the risk premium starts to disappear as, you know, loans and competition heats up. You get pressure from your stockholders to grow your balance sheet and grow your bottom line. You have to meet those pressures by stretching further and further for yield. And the risk premiums probably were higher after the last, probably in the 80s, you know, during the last crisis. You know, you kind of get a wake-up call and you go back to more normal lending. And then as you get further and further away, you forget you have lenders that haven't been there before. They can't remember the last time it was. They couldn't remember how to collect a loan. You know, they didn't have to collect a loan, so they forget about that. And so, you know, you get away from that memory, and once you get too far away from that memory, then, you know, all of a sudden it snaps back.
How will the people who just purchased homes be affected by the in the last few weeks? Is there a difference between 6 weeks and now? Is it going to be a negative effect for them? Like the new homeowners, brand new loans, 2 months to now?
It really depends upon the amount that they purchased, the amount of equity they have in the home, and what kind of mortgage loan they've got. That's really a key. Those with sufficient down payments and a loan, whether it be fixed or floating, but if they borrowed the right amount relative to their income, they can weather this out. Property values will, in fact, go up. It's just that property values in general outside of real GDP and population growth over a long period of time, property values just can't go up more than that. Yet in the last decade, they went up 100%. Well, we didn't have real GDP and population growth of 100% in the last decade. So they got ahead of themselves, but the supply-demand imbalance will catch up at some point. So if the mortgage is affordable, then no, there's not a problem, and really it's just you have to be patient.
Yeah, and I think, too, building on Mike's previous statement about Omaha and Council Bluffs kind of being in an island, if you're in this area, I think you're probably much more secure than, say, some East Coast or West Coast or South Florida. You know, I think there's going to be much more volatility there. There was much more on the upside in those markets, much more on the downside coming down, but this has been a more stable area.
I'm not sure I grasp the entire concept of our economic crisis we're in right now, but how does it compare to the Wall Street crash of 1929, I guess, is like what I've been thinking about lately in terms of the scope of it and everything.
I can take that one, I think. There was a good article in the Wall Street Journal, by the way, on this this morning in the C section, but the crash in 29 was excessive speculation specifically focused on stocks. There was very little regulation of lending at that point in time. In 1929, most people borrowed money straight from the bank, went out and bought stock. As a matter of fact, some corporations would issue stock, turn around and lend the money out to individuals so that they could go buy more stock. And there was no such thing as a margin requirement. You could borrow 80, 90, 95% of the value of the stock you were purchasing, so a 5% decline means all your equity was wiped out. So it was a very different environment at that point in time. It was technically driven and by speculation and a lack of regulation. what we have now is just more a case of excess in terms of liquidity, excess in terms of some speculation involved, but it was more that the real excess in speculation was really on the fixed income side, not on the equity side. All you're seeing in this stock market crash is not a result of extra leverage in the stocks themselves, but extra leverage in some of the companies that are represented in those shares. So it's very different at this point in time. And the economic environment is very different at this point in time also, not only domestically, but in terms of the global issues.
I'll follow up to that one a little bit. Looking back at that crisis in 1929, from what I understand, one of the issues that we had was a very tight money supply. Compared to now, where the money supply is rather high, and as Eric mentioned earlier, to banks, cash is king. And if you take a holistic view, looking at the tragedy up in Minneapolis not too long ago with that bridge collapse, would it not be prudent at this time to kind of react a little bit like we did in 1929 and start having the government infusing money into infrastructure rather than bailing out those who made bad decisions?
That probably be a good idea at this point in time, but the immediate problem really is liquidity. Is the liquidity crisis, and that's pretty much all that they're focused on right now in Washington. Beyond that, it'll take a while. But you did touch on a subject that, don't get me started too much on this. One of the significant contributors to this crisis was too much liquidity, and it caused a crisis in the financial system that's being solved with more liquidity. So the real trick going forward is how do we suck out this excess liquidity out of our economy at just the right time before recovery starts to avoid having an inflationary recovery? That's going to be the key. And now whether you do that with public works, you do that with taxes, do that with money supply, I don't know for sure. Money supply is not the tool it used to be in terms of its effectiveness. So that really is the crux of how we get out of this mess, but it's going to take a while to evolve.
Yeah, and I think too the difference between like 1929 and now is, back in 29 they didn't really start those projects until the 30s, probably 33, so there was quite a bit of lag there, and I think that probably deepened the depression. So.
Yeah, unemployment in the early 30s was about 25%. We're not going to get anywhere close to that at this point in time. So maybe they can throw some money at it, but I don't know if they're going to come up with really the WPA public works kind of thing that that we had then.
Well, I'd just like to add a comment, and I'm certainly not picking on you, but I hear quite commonly the sentiment that these people made bad choices, we should just let them fail. That's a very appealing sentiment when you're talking about the CEO and the board of directors and so on. But just remember, for example, Merrill Lynch, which is one of the companies that was in severe difficulties, had 45,000 employees, and Lehman Brothers had 50,000 employees. You don't just put the CEO out of work. You put another 100,000 people out of work, and those people, frankly, are the people just like us sitting in this room. So while it's appealing to make emotional reactions or have emotional reactions to situations, hopefully people will take a more strategic, steely-eyed look at it and say, all right, in the long term, what is the best decision to make here? And honestly, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, I really think that's what Congress tried to do, which is why it was not an easy thing for them to devise a solution to nor to vote for.
If this crisis was foreseen, then why did we wait for the bubble to burst before doing anything about it?
I can't just get away with human nature. The excesses were foreseen. The rapid bursting of the bubble was not well forecast, certainly. And the degree of the decline... And quite frankly, some of it's because the financial systems have gotten rather complicated. The ability of some very intelligent people in Wall Street to find the nooks and crannies and exceptions to disguise the amount of risk that they're actually taking, and the inability of risk management systems to keep up with the creativity of the financial engineers masked some of the amplitude, if you will. And so no one was really expecting a bursting of this kind. And quite frankly, some of the markets have overdone it. Yet there was true panic in the stock market and in sections of the bond market. Otherwise, Treasury bills wouldn't be selling at 0.02% yield. There was panic, and the flight to safety came to the U.S. dollar, went into the Treasury market, and people absolutely ignored any asset with risk in it for several weeks. And so it was overdone. But it was a surprise in terms of the severity of it, I think, because of it was a lack of understanding of the amount of risks that were taken on financial balance sheets.
My question is, even after having $700 billion put in the finance sector, we see the financial situation going down every day. How long do you think it will take for financial sector to start picking up again?
It shouldn't take too long to at least stop getting worse. But keep in mind the $700 billion, the TARP program, they actually had a press release that said you're supposed to call it a rescue, not a bailout. The TARP program has really only just been signed. They haven't spent a nickel of it yet. It's going to start hopefully yet this week, but they're kind of running out of time. Monday's a holiday in the financial markets for Columbus Day, so it may not happen until next week, but they really haven't started to do anything yet in terms of buying distressed assets to relieve pressure on capital. And a lot of people are waiting for that because there's been some, the FASB calls it clarification, I would call it a little bit of softening in terms of fair market value accounting, assuming that many of these assets are at distressed levels now and that is not a fair value. When the TARP program begins to purchase these assets off of balance sheets, that will establish a more realistic fair value, hopefully. Hopefully they do it correctly with their reverse auctions and other tricks, but hopefully that will help establish a real fair value that will almost instantly take a little relief off the capital strains on the financial institutions, and that will be the start of the recovery of the balance sheets in the financial sector and the start of the recovery in terms of slowing down the decline and beginning the healing process of growing balance sheet in a more orderly fashion.
Just like to say thank you to everyone for those excellent questions, and today's session of the College of Business Speaker Series program is adjourned. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Bellevue University College of Business Speaker Series. We've heard a panel discussion on the topic, The Financial and Mortgage Industry Crisis, What It Means for Business and You. The members of the panel were Eric Bunderson, Vice President of American National Bank, Mike Gallagher, Vice President of Human Resources at Harrah's Horseshoe and Council Bluffs, and Pat Miner, Vice President and Public Bond Portfolio Manager at Mutual of Omaha. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, October 9th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jason Keyes, Assistant Director of Public Relations at Bellevue University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.